Hello.
Hello.
Now, I think there's an issue that we need to address now that we're at episode 5. We haven't really spoken about this. The theme tune to this podcast may seem as incongruous as a police box in a modern lane or on an alien planet. And that's because we decided we needed a theme tune, and so I knocked one up in GarageBand in 10 minutes. And I think it's quite tuneful, but it doesn't have the Doctor Who theme in or anything. And, you know, if you've got a problem with that, then please write a strongly worded letter of complaint to, let's say, Toby Haydock. So, welcome to episode 5 of
Season to Taste.
My name's Will.
And I'm Matt.
And in this podcast, in case you haven't been keeping up or haven't already listened to the first 4, which is fair enough, we are working our way through the 35 active years of Doctor Who. Basically, every year there was some new Doctor Who, and we're tasting an example of that year. So far, we've been to the second Matt Smith series, we've been to The Trial of a Time Lord, Sylvester McCoy's second series, and in this episode, we've just watched from Season 9, The Time Monster. A brave choice, you might think, and I think we both remembered that we'd kind of enjoyed it when we'd seen it in the past, and therefore maybe wasn't as courageous as the doubters might say. But having sat through the 6 episodes of The Time Monster, it's not one of the best of the Pertwee era, is it?
Well, I think it's less ooh and more
ooh. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. although actually, to be fair to it, it's actually more oh, because the last third isn't as bad as the
I think once it gets to Atlantis, actually, the whole thing really picks up and starts to move somewhere. I mean, the last couple of episodes, you've got the Master seducing Queen Galea, which is really interesting. It's a really nice use of the character. You've got...
And something we've not really seen before.
No, you've got kind of the Daisiest Daisy sequence, which is rightly famous, I think. It's a nice Pertwee moment of charm. He's got a lovely interaction with Katie Manning once they get away from the whole nonsense at Cambridge University, and it's just the two of them flying around time and space. They've got a lovely doctor-companion relationship. So I think there's loads of things that I like about the last part of the episode, but I think there's lots of things that are not so good about the first 4 episodes. Most notably, I think, the fact that no one who's writing it apparently understands anything that they've written.
It is a story entirely powered by technobabble. I think in Tom Tit, all 3 T's stand for technobabble, and possibly the M as well. It's just so hard to follow, and it does have that feeling that the writers are saying, well, we kind of know what we vaguely mean, but... oh, it's science fiction, it's fine, we'll just say whatever. And, you know, it really doesn't hang together. And then on top of that, compounding it, you have the Brigadier being particularly sceptical and difficult, even though he's actually been at this for quite a while now. You've got...
Well, he accuses Captain Yates of being drunk at one point. And you initially thought that was a joke.
I think it is a joke.
But I'm not sure... that it is, because he then says, you have been drinking, Yates, or something like that. As though it actually does think that,
I mean, you have that
Captain Yates is drunk.
You have the really clunky... There's a lot of attempts at humour, which is understandable, and there is one place where we actually laughed our heads off, because it was, which is the moment when the TARDIS dematerialises in the wood, and whoever that bystander character is, just looks at it and goes, Londoners. And that's really funny. Unfortunately, a lot of the other attempts at humour almost fall into pastiche of the series, which is something I wouldn't have thought Barry Letts would have done. And possibly he wouldn't have let other people get away with. But there's a feeling every now and again some of the jokes almost make the tropes of the series the butt of the joke. And then you've got the two scientists... working for Professor Tuscalas, who, I mean, what's Ruth, she's called, isn't
Ruth,
she?
Possibly one of the worst performances in any Doctor Who story ever. Well, it's certainly the worst performance in a story that's not really rich spiders. With lots of great performances. Oh, sorry, one of the worst major performances, yeah. I guess I mean. Not.
I mean, she... I kind of feel slightly sorry for the actress, because she's lumbered with saying the word man or woman in nearly every one of her lines. I remember that old interview where Liz Sladen says, I don't know if women's lib was ever mentioned, and my word is it mentioned in The Time Monster. The character of Dr. Ruth is just obsessed by everything, until she wants to start having a go at men for not being butch enough. I mean, she's all over the place.
I thought she was going to break in at one point to that kind of fembot language in Futurama. I thought she was going to say femsplain or something like that. She couldn't say anything.
I must refer this to my womager. She's a...
Oh, you silly man-puter.
I'm just a fembot femputer in a manbot manputer's world. Is that and it's so 70s. They look so 70s. Stuart's house stroke Diggs is incredibly 70s.
Do you know, I think that's part of the charm, though. That's one thing that I really do like, is that that story looks like the 1970s compressed into 1 hour, 150 minutes of screen time.
It does, although I find it, even if that was a nice view of the 1970s, you'd think that when the Doctor and Joe finally get into the TARDIS, you wouldn't then discover he's had a 1970s makeover for the TARDIS.
Which is commented on, even.
They even comment on it. And it's quite convenient, given the Master's TARDIS is in the story, that the makeover he's chosen looks just like the Master's TARDIS.
It is, very, very convenient. But I think you've got Joe's lovely knee-length yellow boots and that kind of weird white furry coat thing. Ruth wearing that purple tank top with
the flowery pattern,
purple flowery thing. And Stu, is he wearing a yellow cravat, a mustard cravat?
He's got some
like
sort
that.
Of horrible neck gear on, plus his handlebar moustache.
Yeah. I just love the look of it, because I do kind of in general love the look of the early 1970s and the colours.
This is why you're not allowed to do the decorating in our house.
Perhaps one of the many reasons. But we picked the Time Monster because we were trying to pick something that was representative of the season. And one of the things that we debate when we pick the story is what's most representative of the season. And I thought it was quite interesting, as we were watching the Time Monster, it's like watching the UNIT era dying before your eyes. You can kind of understand why the next story, they just say, right, UNIT era's ended, he's going to go back into time and space. Because actually, it almost feels like they've got nowhere to go with it. The Brigadier, as you've pointed out, Will, is almost a comedy parody
of how
we was.
Parody.
You've got UNIT being entirely ineffectual. Their only task in the whole story is to deliver the TARDIS to the Doctor so that it can fly off and have an adventure. They don't do anything other than that that's of any use whatsoever. And it's almost like the Doctor's now outgrown UNIT. They're no longer of any use to him other than their errand boys.
The Master, who's been running his mastery plots for a while, very much tied into the UNIT era, even he's reduced to, like, bidding for funding for his project.
It's a bizarrely low-rent story. The Doctor is incredibly passive for the first... Well, all the way through, actually, the Doctor is tied up, or he's on the back foot, or he's... You know,
just
building,
not there.
Yeah, it's just not there. There's a couple of middle episodes where he's sitting in Stu's room building some nonsense out of wine bottle.
Oh, ridiculous thing with the forks.
But he's not.
Oh, it's cringeworthy.
The main protagonist of the story is the Master. It's very much the Master's story.
It is the
first... You're actually invested more in his plan and his activity than you are in anything that the Doctor's doing.
I mean, it's quite a nice... I mean, you can see why Master Who didn't take off, because it's not a brilliant... story, but you can, it really is, you watch and go, we're following the Master at the lab, we're following the Master controlling the Director, we're following the Master's will they won't they love affair with Galea. It is very much the Master's story.
He even gets his own companion, doesn't he?
In Crossis. Yeah. And to be fair, you can understand why they might have wanted to put so much effort in, because the Master's a popular character, and actually in a story which is, and we commented on this, not just the Doctor doesn't do anything. You go episodes at a time where nothing really happens, which in a six-episode story makes it quite a slog.
And I think that's unusual for the Pertwee era.
It's normally they manage to actually make the six episodes justify, even the seven episodes.
Yeah.
But it's really, there's a real dip and lack of action. They really could have done it in four, if not three episodes. But what carries it over that and makes it just about watchable, even when that's happening, is Pertwee, Manning and Delgado. The three of them have the charisma and presence to deal with, you know, to keep you watching and to maintain your interest. You know, the master flouncing around and, oh, and that wonderful scene, one that I do love, and you suddenly realise that basically the entire first bit of The Curse of Fatal Death is based on it. That scene where the Doctor and the Master are talking on each other's screens in the TARDIS, and and the Doctor just genuinely goes, he's turned off the sound! There's even a bit, and I can't remember where it is, where I think they kind of practically do the architect dinner buying from The Curse of Fatal Death. I'm not sure, I can't remember what it's about now. Maybe it was about Kronos and who was going to control him. But even that was in there. And you suddenly go, yeah, The Curse of Fatal Death takes quite a lot from this story. And it's one of the most entertaining bits of the story. It's ridiculous. The two of them just talking to each other. They're Skyping between
it
TARDISes.
It is, but I think
But it's really entertaining because all the characters involved are watchable.
I agree, but I think it's very representative of a story that's really run out of things to say. I think what's really interesting to me about the story is kind of, it does feel like the UNIT era has run its course and we've run out of interesting things to say or do with this group of characters. So other than them being charming and kind of carrying it just because you like them, there's nothing inherently interesting about the story.
They even have the Pertwee era civil servants come back yet again for an inspection at the beginning, don't they? And we've seen them in Inferno and we've seen them in The Claws of Axos, and actually this time they're really unmemorable and they're just almost, again, another trope of the era that isn't really working in that story.
If it does feel like maybe a UNIT story too far, a Master story too far. It feels maybe like they flogged the Trapped on Earth concept to death and actually it's now time to go and do something new. You just can't imagine them having to follow that with yet another season where they're trapped on Earth fighting the Master.
And you can feel, that's why I think you feel the real lift when they do get to Atlantis in the end. All those weird scenes early on in the kind of film studios with the just black draped background, which don't quite make a lot of sense until later on, if they make any sense then, but they kind of do. But when they're actually in Atlantis, suddenly the whole tempo and mode changes and you've got these wonderful, not particularly great sets. They're good, but they're not realistic. But actually, they're entirely in keeping with something like I, Claudius. Yeah. They look like they could be the I, Claudius sets. I mean, they're very in keeping with how the BBC would have done kind of Roman Greek drama at that time. But they're not very realistic. They have just got like a bit of blue in the background to represent the sky.
But I think you're right. It kind of opens the whole story up, and it feels like everyone's breathing a sigh of relief because they're getting to be creative and do something exciting.
And also, you've got a whole load of new characters with their own different motives and attitudes. Yeah. And Galea's interesting, and King Dalios is actually really good. I may have made a slight faux pas about King Dalios. we were watching him, and I said, oh, this character really reminds me of Campo from Planet of the Spiders. And Matt said, that would be because it's the actor who plays Campo.
But I think...
I just remembered, we also, not only did I not know that, neither of us had registered that Susan Penhaligon had been in Doctor Who.
No, it's Larkis, is it?
Larkis. Yeah, the Lackey.
Yeah. But I think, for me, the Time Monster is kind of representative of season 9 because it does have that whole, it's almost got four episodes of torturous justification for them actually doing an Atlantis story. And it kind of highlights the problems that Barry Letts and Terrence Dicks were now finding in telling the stories that they wanted to tell within the constraints that Derek Sherwin had set down for them in 1969. So you can kind of see they've pushed now the idea to its conclusion that the Doctor has slight control of the TARDIS. Every story in season 9 is not a straightforward invasion of Earth story. There's kind of multiple time zones as they go to the future in Day of the Daleks. The Doctor manages to go to Peladon in The Curse of Peladon. UNIT's not in The Sea Devils, which is otherwise the most straightforwardly traditional trapped on Earth type story. Obviously, the mutants, the Time Lords, the big justification for the Doctor being able to go to an alien planet is the Time Lords send him there, just as they did in Colony in Space. So it feels like the Time Monster is another attempt to kind of address the fact that, yes, we know the format of the series is that he's supposed to be on Earth, but we don't really have any more stories that we can tell about being trapped on Earth. So we're going to do this big techno-babbly four episodes of nonsense, because actually we really want to do the most 1972-ish story imaginable, i.e. COD mysticism, Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World type mysticism.
I'm sure they could have done lots more Trapped in Other stories. I guess part of the, it's more from week to week. You don't want it every week. You want to have some Earth-based stories, but you want to actually mix it up. And you know, this is a series about a man who's got a box that can go anywhere in space and time, and it's very restrictive not to take advantage of that, and you're missing out on lots of opportunities. We've had quite a go at the time, but I do want to have a go, even though we've already pretty much beaten it into submission. There are two other things I want to point out about it. One is, I don't think it's well directed. There were some particular moments where I just thought, why on earth are you shooting the back of Roger Delgado's head while he's having this big conversation? Lots of bits here and there where I just thought the choices were not very good. And the other is just how bad Kronos is. The whole flapping bird. You've got one moment where Kronos finally appears, this all-powerful, really major being, this mythological beast, and the master just closes a door and traps him in a room. And you're like, really? Is that... That's how powerful Kronos is? The master can just shut a door and he's trapped until the master wants to use him. Although, the good thing about Kronos is in the groovy era at the end, when you finally see her face and she's talking to them, and actually it's really... The thing she says about she could be good, she could be bad, she can do what she wants, is actually straight out of Silver Nemesis. It's the Nemesis statue saying it's how she's been created.
Or vice versa.
Well, obviously... in the order. But I thought, given that we just watched Silver Nemesis, the similarity between Kronos at the end and the Nemesis statue is really quite interesting.
Well, although we've been quite critical of the Time Monster, I am really glad that we've watched it, because it's the first time that I've ever properly watched it, as I said last time. And I'm glad now that I've really watched it. I can appreciate why it's got the reputation that it has. Unfortunately, I kind of agree that it should.
I think perhaps when we first watched it, because it does lift at the end, we kind of then gave it more of the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, and it's got lots of nice little moments that we've pointed out.
Any story that ends with John Levine naked actually doesn't have a strong ending.
I think the Barry Letts and Philip Hinchcliffe seasons are probably the most consistently strong run of Doctor Who in the classic era, probably only comparable to like the Russell T Davies consistency. So there's very few episodes in that whole 7-8 year period that are actively really bad. I think, unfortunately, the Time Monster's possibly one of, you know, a handful, if that. It was good to watch. I mean, I'm glad we picked it. And as I say, I think it's quite representative of the conflict in season 9 between carrying on the Trapped on Earth story that had kind of worked quite well for them over the past 2 years, and actually wanting to get away and back to doing what Doctor Who does best, which is going anywhere in time and space.
And certainly after that, I'm looking forward to seeing some of seasons 7, 8, 10 and 11. Cool, well, maybe then it's time to consult the entrails of a sheep. No, that's not right. Consult the randomizer to tell us which of those years, or of the remaining years, we have to look at next. So I'm going to switch on the randomizer, ready to
What's all these knobs?
They're not for you. Keep your hands off. I am going to ask the randomizer to pick the year, the season, that we are next to taste. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. You've forgotten to take your pills again, haven't you? Well, this is interesting. We are...
Is that interesting in the... way that finding a body is interesting.
No, it's interesting in the sense that we are going back in the other direction.
Oh, towards the future. Back to the future.
We're going back to this Saturday night. We're sending us back to the future. We are going to what on my screen, the randomizer says, is number 27. In other words, Paul McGann.
Well, this is going to be an interesting debate, isn't it?
Yep. So the episodes we have to choose from are Doctor Who and the Enemy Within the TV Movie.
Grace 1999.
Now, we should, rather than just ending there, I mean, you did suggest, and it's not a view I'm particularly keen to entertain, but we should talk about it, that given the paucity of Eighth Doctor stories on the television box, we should consider one of the audios, one of the even one of the books, but I think the audios were your main...
Yeah.
Look at the continuing series on audio. If, hypothetically, we were to do that, which one would we go for? You know the audios much better than I do.
Oh, that's a tough question. So my favourite Eighth Doctor audios are the ones with Sheridan Smith as Lucy Miller. I think, particularly towards the end of the four series that they did together, those are some of Big Finish's strongest of all their audios. Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith just have a great working relationship together. The audios have really good casts a lot of the time. And I really enjoyed them. So I would probably pick something like... Oh, I don't know. I love Relative Dimensions by Mark Platt. I love Jonathan Morris's Resurrection of Mars two-parter. I think there's some really good stuff in that fourth series that's really repays a listen. So I would be very happy to listen to a Paul McGann and Sheridan Smith audio. And then equally you've got some good stuff with India Fisher and Paul McGann from early on in Big Finish's productions when they were doing things like The Chimes of Midnight, which is one of the most acclaimed spin-off stories ever, Robert Sherman's kind of creepy Christmas house story, Paul Cornell's Seasons of Fear, which is great fun and has a great little returning villain. And you've got Invaders from Mars, which is quite fun. Mark Gatiss.
Oh, that's the one with Simon Pegg.
And Jessica Stevenson, yeah.
Hines in. I might be tempted to have maybe do a bonus one of one of those. And I think we should do a Lucy Miller one.
Yeah.
If we were going to. And so we'll get you to pick one of those. I do think, though, I mean, part of the way we've set this up is we've talked about the different active years of Doctor Who. And so although we've said 27 represents the Eighth Doctor, it really represents 1996.
It does.
And unless we're going to read Stacey and Sard in the Radio Times comic.
Sard off.
Yes, okay. Sard off, I am. Oh, rude. our only real option is to say that, you know, at midnight tonight, this world is going to be pulled inside out.
Yeah.
Grace 1999 it is.
Pucker up.
Does she kiss as good as me?
As well as you.
He doesn't deliver that line right, does he? I was really confused at the time. I thought he was actually saying he'd kissed her as well, and indeed it was as well as you. I didn't get that he was doing the...
Oh, I think she's kissed everyone. Slap her.
But let's save commentary on what's actually in the story. We don't have to weigh it up against any others. It's going to be the Seagal Spectacular... just called Doctor Who. So, that's to look forward to next time. That's another easy one that's going to get out of the way. We're saving another seven-story season for the future to discuss. It is as simple as that. The randomizer has told us that we're going to watch the TV movie. And so we shall. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye. I had a dream, Will, that it was going to be season 26. So let's see if the randomizer keeps its side of the bargain.
Are you making a face to me as if to say, whatever it says, say it's season 26?
No. I'm making a face at you to say, edit this so that I predict what season's going to come up in a Time Monster Esquire.
Oh, I see. So you mean you want to sound like the Odeon ticket line, so you say, ah, yes, I had a dream last night and I imagined it would be... Season 12!
Exactly that.
Yeah. So, listeners, we won't be doing that.
You can edit that out.